This episode of Walter Edgar's Journal is an encore of a previously broadcast program.
Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. With me in the studio today is Greg Johnsman, better known as Geechee Boy from Edisto Island, and C.J. Lotes, who is a journalist and has written an article recently in Garden Gun about grits. And so, both of you, welcome to the Journal.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. Grits. Let's start off. Are they singular or plural?
As you're touching on, that's one of many debates about grits. If you say grits are or grits is.
It's, you know, I look at a different part. It's hard to eat just one little piece of corn, so you can't have just one grit. So it kind of has to be grits.
I'm with Greg. Grits are them. I didn't have it for breakfast. I had them for breakfast. I guess these English language purists, they want to deconstruct everything, whatever. But when CJ, when you were researching your article, I'm sure you got into that with folks.
It turns out Garden and Gun readers and many people across the South have strong opinions on grits. And I worked on this piece for over a year, gathering tips and advice from chefs and writers and people from all over the South. And there's not one way to make grits. There's not one way to select them or cook them. And like you said, people have strong opinions, whether they ate them growing up or they just confronted them for the first time in a restaurant. They raise a lot of thoughts from people across the South.
My friend John Shelton Reed, who retired up at Chapel Hill, who would use various things to test the line, where is Dixie? And when you got far enough north where grits was not on the menu, and it was usually by the time you got to Northern Virginia, you couldn't get it. He said, "Or that's the border."
But not anymore. Not anymore. I mean, years ago when I had a call from Portland, Maine, I asked them if they were calling the right person. But there's a southern contingency that absolutely is up in that area. But Baltimore over in D.C., it's kind of a melting pot. But, you know, we're selling grits about as far as you can go and beyond.
Well, actually, I have eaten some of your grits in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Well,
but what I was thinking, the general restaurant, not specialty restaurants, you're not going to see grits on the breakfast menu. You will see hash browns.
And I think it's important to remember that grits started in home kitchens. Like you said, you had them as a child. People started by cooking that as their starch. Instead of bread at their meal, it would be grits for breakfast, maybe grits with a little something on top for lunch. Again, grits for dinner. It was the main starch, like rice or bread.
CJ, you said you spent a year researching this, the ultimate guide to grits. And boy, did you take on a very brave person to say this is the ultimate guide to grits, because then you have 10 different ways to prepare grits.
I was really sticking my neck out there saying it's the ultimate guide to grits. But then by canvassing all these different chefs, more than 50 people, I get to have their opinion. So it's not CJ Lotes' opinion on grits. It's 50 different people, including Frank Stitt, Emeril Lagasse, Natalie Dupree, Greg Johnsman, people from all over sharing their tips.
All right. Well, Greg, since we've got you in the room, I need to remind our listeners that as Geechee Boy, that you produce Stone Ground grits.
That is correct. I mean, that's kind of how we started. You know, we were a commercial tomato farm, and when I married into the family, we've converted all the acreage and family members to growing heirloom grains to kind of do the quest of what we call a rice kitchen, meaning that a rice kitchen is using each heirloom grain crop to help the next in the rotation. But my heart starts and beats with corn and especially grits. And when we talk about that, you know, there's so many varieties out there, and what we're concentrating on is varietals that grow, land-raised varieties in particular, that grow in the South.
All right. Have you gone back to, I would say, heritage?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Forms? Yeah. I mean, the earliest variety we're working with is called Guinea Flint. Came out of Cuba in the early 1500s and came here to the South. And all these varieties of corns were treasured by cultures and people before us and brought for some reason to areas. And this area has certain with our daylight sensitivity is what can grow here. A quick story to tell you about what daylight sensitivity is and what that means is when we were at tomato farm, one of the workers brought his prized ear of corn from Mexico to my father-in-law and had the most beautiful, almost, it's hard to believe, but 18, 20-inch long ear of corn. And I was thinking, this is going to be the cheapest way to make the most grits. I can't wait to grow it. And we grew it And all I got was stalk, and I'm talking almost 20 feet of stalk. So the daylight sensitivity never let the ear of corn grow here because it wasn't meant to grow here. So I think it's important to understand that not every varietal is going to make good grits, and not every varietal is going to grow where you want it to grow. So we try to concentrate on what was here in the South.
Well, sometimes in stores you can see purple grits. Not just the usual white grits that we grew up with. And I know that there are older varieties of corn that were colored. Do you just traditionally grow white and yellow corn?
We started that way, and the longer we've got and deeper we've got into, and it's something I think CJ got to explore as we got to work with different varietals. You know, the blue, as we call it, that we grow, actually, if you use acidity like lemon or lime juice or buttermilk, but buttermilk's not as strong, it heightens the color. So many vegetables and things you work with, you don't get the color to come out. So it's very exciting that the pink corn and the blue corn gets to retain its color. Red is in the outside layer, so we try to incorporate some of the bran, but you can't see the full beauty in that product. But what it does is the starch and sugar contents change, and that's where the flavor profile comes from, and that's what we're looking for in every variety. There's probably hundreds and hundreds of varieties to look at, but we're after taste.
All right. How many varieties do you grow?
I don't know off the top of my head, but we're working with about 7 to 8 currently, and another thing for listeners to understand is I can't plant these all side by side because they're open pollinated. And what that means is when the pollination occurs, they can cross pollinate and ruin each variety. So the Sea Islands gives us the advantage that we can separate crops and put them away from each other. But some of the varieties are so different in daylight sensitivity as much as pollination periods that we can put them in at different points. Meaning, as an example, most dent corns were after in the neighborhood about 120 days of pollination. Guinea flint's only 65 days. So it's very easy to put that crop next to another and it won't hurt each other. So we try to spread it out. And then another thing to talk about is the last 4 years, we've had 4 major storms and have ruined probably 2/3 of this ability to grow. So we're trying to now expand and work with another. As we grow, we're working with a group of farmers all over the state saying, instead of putting all our eggs in one basket on the coast, we're trying to move some into Columbia, Holly Hill, Orangeburg. I've got some in Sherrall. I've got some over in Georgetown. So what we're trying to do is, in case something happens, have an area that we can continue to go.
So you've expanded your enterprise beyond just growing on your family place. You have got farmers around the state who are growing, and then they harvest and you produce the grits.
Yeah, but I think the exciting thing is that these families are buying into my crazy idea. I mean, when you go to a farmer and you say, this makes the best grits, yet it's only going to produce a 15th of what you're used to. And even though we can pay you more, it's still not going to be the same amount. A lot of people don't get that. But, you know, I think people are wanting to help save and they're wanting to understand that there is a future in this. And as we can grow and people can kind of get associated with the flavor profile and chefs are willing and then it trickles down into the homeowner. It's kind of the opposite. CJ was saying it started with the homeowner. Now we're kind of asking the chefs to tell the story and then get the homeowner back into it.
All right. CJ, let's pursue that a little bit more, because today somebody can go into the grocery store and yes, you can buy Geechee Boy grits. You can also buy Anson Mill grits, which are also done stone ground. But then most people think, instant grits. And when they say they bought instant grits, I want to put a blessing over them and for whatever they're going to eat. It just doesn't, there is no taste.
Right.
To instant grits.
Grits tell a generational story. When we look at that farm to table discussion and we go back to what Greg is trying to do, that's more of our grandparents' generation. And there was a whole period there, especially in the 80s, when instant was the norm. So a lot of people grew up, if they think about their own childhoods, they think about instant and mush and that sort of quick grit. So a little bit of this romanticizing about grits and the way it used to be is another generation back. So would you agree with me, Greg, on that?
Yeah. And Walter, the most interesting thing is how this comes about is hopefully me and CJ can tell you a quick story of going to see an old lady that cooked 45 years on the Dodge plantation on Edisto Island named Miss Emily. And I'm gonna let maybe CJ explain what happened when she got to meet Miss Emily, a near and dear friend of mine, and she's taught me so much about grits over the years.
All right, let's hear it.
Miss Emily is an 87-year-old matriarch of Edisto Island, and people come to her to ask for cooking advice. She's cooked for people all over that island for generations. And she cooks grits the old way, and she has this method of rinsing them. When you go to her house, she cooks over a wood stove. She pours grits into the pan, pours water over them, and then rinses off what she calls the hucks, which are the fibers and the bran that floats to the top. She rinses them two or three times, and then when she cooks them, she's cut the cooking time into about a third. It's amazing. She'll just be talking to you and kind of stirring, talking to you, look over and the grits are done cooking. And she's never burned them. This is just her process of simplifying by rinsing off the hucks.
Well, the grits that I ate growing up, first of all, it was the last thing in the evening. It was put in the top of a very primitive double boiler in water and let to sit overnight. And then it was cooked over that double boiler the next morning. It was never cooked directly on the fire.
Sounds like the way that your family was cooking them is the same as Vivian Howard, the chef. She uses a double boiler as well to reduce that stirring time. So people have come up with all these different methods. Soaking overnight, Miss Emily on Edisto rinses off the hucks. Other people use a double boiler. There are many different ways to tackle the grit successfully.
Well, I think today it's hard in some restaurants to get plain grits. Everybody wants to have grits that have been gussied up. It's not just plain grits. And you had a number of different ways that grits were presented in your article. You had 10, right?
We did more than two recipes. We shared two recipes and then shared many ways that people gussy them or fuss them up. Are you saying, do you enjoy them plain, just plain grits?
Well, I like them plain. Sometimes I add a little bit of cheese. When I was growing up and getting those every morning for breakfast, it was usually just with butter and usually bacon or sausage. But if we had something else, like my dad had brought in doves, we might have a little bit of gravy. We had company from cousins, actually, from Tennessee, and they wanted to put sugar on the grits. And, of course, that was absolutely forbidden. You don't do that.
Sugar on grits would be fighting words in the South.
Yeah, there's the sugar and the syrup. You have to be careful with the word syrup because there is some Southern syrups, but if they're referring to maple syrup, it's the same as sugar. That's not something you typically. You know, I work as a craft to try to bring the best corn forward, so it's hard for me to watch somebody before they even taste the bounty of that varietal to see them put a spoonful of sugar in it without even first trying it first.
Try them plain first. Learn the different flavor profiles. And then universally, people enjoy butter on grits. I'd say a little pat of butter is pretty universal.
So a quick kind of sensory for the listeners to maybe understand is there's things that I kind of think of in Mother Nature and beyond to kind of think of these different varieties. So a blue grit is very floral. It has that kind of appeal to it. Jimmy Red, Red Grits, is going to be very nutty. Sean Brock refers to it as banana Laffy Taffy. and you can literally, when we're milling it, smell banana Laffy Taffy. So it's very interesting to kind of look at that. You know, sugars are known higher in white, and yellow is more starchy fat. So that's why moonshiners and a lot of people were after early varieties of white. To keep oil content stuff down. People use different things. And textures, like the word soft and creamy, sometimes is not referred to as texture, but it's referred to as flavor. And there are varietals that kind of give more of a creamier or a soft kind of buttery and whatnot. And then something as far as when you get into flint corns, like the Guinea flint we have is almost an orangish yellow. for the listeners to kind of understand, but it is the most savory stovetop stuffing. You know, if you're going to do a very heavy wine sauce or something, that's going to be the varietal. It's very toothy. It doesn't break down. A flint corn can't break down. So, you know, again, we don't use sweet corns. And I think it's very interesting. People think of sweet corns, you know, Silver Queen and all these names they know. But that's a very new variety of corn. We're looking at corns from the 1500s to the 1800s. And sweet corn's in the 1940s and 50s. So and you can't mill sweet corn. It'd be mush inside the mill. So these are Dent and Flint corns. These are, you know, these are harder corns. And then the other funny thing, talk about flavor, is there's things of a – I think CJ got a chance to maybe hear from people about this. Is there's a memory attached. So I always say grandma, but what ends up happening is some areas think like Chicago is yellow grits only. I don't know why, but they order only yellow grits. But yet in North Carolina, a certain region, yellow is only feed. I would never put feed in my mouth is what I've been told by people. And that doesn't represent the whole state of North Carolina. It's just areas that – so they have a memory attached that whatever was grown or whatever was created in a kitchen, that they associate a flavor profile as well that needs to kind of be known.
That's a North Carolina thing I came across a lot, that – in North Carolina, the yellow corn would be more considered feed. But then in New Orleans, yellow corn grits are considered to have more flavor that can stand up to the meatier gravies, sauces. So there's strong opinions about who should be eating yellow versus white, if that's more of a feed product or if it stands up to flavors. Across the board, it's different.
Well, since I grew up in Mobile, Alabama, I grew up with yellow.
Yep.
And what we've done to fix it is in Georgia, some of the millers that taught me as a kid, they call it Georgia ice cream. So it's mixed. So we call it speckled grits here in South Carolina. I can't steal the title of Georgia ice cream and all. But, you know, it's about 2/3 white to 1/3 yellow. If you do 50-50, it's too powerful of a color. But I think it's the best of both worlds for so many people. And it's a starting point. That's what we get asked that all the time, you know, like, what's the best grits? Where should I start? I was like, start with the basics. Start with white or yellow. Start with speckled. See what you like. And then from there, begin. And then begin the quest to kind of see what you can do.
So the speckled are sort of your gateway drug into grits?
Well, that's one way of stating it. It's a way for them to kind of get the best of both worlds, keep everybody happy at the table and all. But it is. It's like CJ said, it's a very opinionated conversation. And, you know, I also get asked, like, well, how do you cook your grits?
And Greg, we'll get to that in just a minute, but we're going to have to pause for a moment and let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with CJ Lotes and Greg Johnsman about grits. All right, Greg, how do you cook your grits?
Well, I don't know if we stated before, but I don't know how often people eat grits. But imagine if you're in my world that you mill every day and you mill tons and tons of corn. So there is always a pot of grits going, and my waistline shows it from always having some grits. But when my boys were little, I've got a 9 and a 6-year-old. I think it was interesting. You know, it kind of starts as a basic butter grits, but over time, we've created the simple, fast recipe, as I call it, the dump recipe, which is probably not the best name, or the pot liquor. And it works because it's so fast and anybody likes it. So it's any varietal grits, for some reason, casserole style. So I prefer a yellow for the look of it. And then as the grits are cooking in the next pan right next to the grits, a whole log, a whole thing of Jimmy Dean sausage, cooked quick, crumbled up. As soon as the grits are done, dump in the whole thing of Jimmy Dean sausage, as much cheese as your refrigerator owns, and a whole can of Rotel. And the Rotel is kind of hot sauce, tomatoes, peppers, but it's all in there. And you would think little kids wouldn't eat it and stuff, but it's so simple and it's so fast. And I think that's just the way I live. But I get to taste them all directions, but that's my go-to. And I've never had a pot made that hasn't been completely licked clean by the end.
Well, you're talking about basically creating a casserole, and I consider that upscale grits, because if you go to modern caterers, particularly if they're doing a brunch, they will put a fancy casserole with their own specialty on the table. Now, I mentioned earlier about grits on the menu not going north, and that's maybe a bit old-fashioned, because anywhere you go now, Seattle, you can find shrimp and grits, and they'll usually actually say Low Country shrimp and grits on the menu.
Giving some credit to South Carolina for the origin of that dish.
Yes.
What's your thought, though, the two y'all on? For me, what I find amazing, because I get to work with so many chefs and home cooks, is when we talk about American food, you know, it's a melting pot of other kind of places. But what I think you see that Low Country is, I think we have a defined path that are natural resources with the fishing and what we can grow with a longer growing season. But I get that call from Seattle, Washington. Eduardo, one of my favorite chefs, is doing exactly that in Washington. He's got grits and Low Country all over the menu, and it's really researching the culture of how food came into the United States for him. And I've got time to spend with him, but he's only one small example of just hundreds and hundreds of people of kind of a defined food way, and I think grits fits into it.
Clearly, South Carolina, especially the Low Country, has become very chic.
It's interesting the popularity of shrimp and grits across the country now, where that started as a seasonal dish. And it wasn't just shrimp and grits, it was fish and grits. It was oysters and grits. Whatever seasonal seafood was coming out of the water at the time, you would stir that up with a little brown gravy and put that over your grits. And then it so happens that shrimp and grits is what became so popular across the country.
Well, that's shrimp and grits is much easier to fix than the other things. And it looks, you know, I love oysters. I'm not real wild about fish and grits, although I had that sometimes growing up. Or quail and grits, that was, or dove and grits. And I knew folks who ate squirrel and grits.
Duck and grits.
Yeah. You know, but shrimp and grits lends itself to being served in a restaurant. You've got your bowl, and they arrange the shrimp very nicely around it. Sadly, sometimes they overdo. It's almost sawmill gravy on top of it. They ruin it. It really shouldn't have any extra. You've got the shrimp and grits. The basics are good.
I think it's what's interesting. You know, Crook's Corner, in my opinion, so helped the shrimp and grits get onto the menu and made that humble dish. You know, my father was an oysterman first before a farmer, and the one-pot recipes coming out of Low Country is so important to hear about fishermen and whatnot cooked in one pot, and that's where a lot of these recipes kind of originated in. And I kind of look at different variations of grits as, you know, if we're at somewhere just having somebody sample it, you're going to make them very creamy and stuff because they're getting one bite. But like you're saying about a gravy, it's got to incorporate the whole dish and not take away when you have that much to eat. So it lends yourself kind of what you're doing in so many different ways. But I do find, you know, CJ and myself went to Miss Emily's, and when she makes her gravy, it's just a remnants of some onions and some grease from the bacon and a little bit of flour, but it's so simple. And that brown gravy is probably the best gravy I've ever had in my life, and it makes the dish come alive. I think part of it, too, is that conversation while you're having that we miss in this today in society is we're all in a fast pace, me including, to stop and to stir that pot. It's enjoyable to get together. And I think that pot is what brings people together.
And people even have opinions about what you stir it with. Frank Stitt in Alabama told me there's something sensual about standing there and stirring with a wooden spoon.
Yes.
Who wants to be stirring metal on metal? You want to have a wooden spoon, talking to people you love, cooking out of whatever you've got, little bits of fat to make your gravy. Stand there, feel the feel of the wooden spoon. That's part of the whole process.
I know. Let's get back to your article, CJ. Why don't you start to go through and talk about the different preparations you came up with?
You know, there's a high and a low to grits. There's a simple pot of grits with a pat of butter on it. And then I mentioned Frank Stitt and how he loves to stir with a wooden spoon. He, at his Highlands Bar and Grill, has a grit souffle that is a French sort of souffle preparation of grits, but using stone ground Alabama grits and bringing this high level of preparation to what ends up being a very simple, luxurious grits dish. Mm-hmm. And the times that they've thought about taking that off the menu, he said it was like people thought he was taking their child away. I mean, that grits dish stays on the menu always, and it doesn't change. So the simple grits dishes. The chef John Fleer in Asheville told me that his dad growing up would take the little packets of grape jelly at a diner and stir those into his grits. So a little something sweet. There's grit cakes in New Orleans where they'll bake the grits and use that as a base for game meat.
So that's different from fried grits, because that's what we used to do with day-old grits, was to let it get cold and then batter and deep fry it.
That's a great point. Early upon of milling with chefs, I had a chef do exactly what you're talking about, of having too many grits for a service, and he came up with the grit tot. And the grit tot was just the congealed grits that he threw into the fryer. And I thought it was the most amazing thing, that it was almost like emulating a mozzarella stick. You know, it had the soft center and then you could dip it in something. And I was like, why are more people not doing this great idea?
What would you dip it in? Marinara sauce?
He had it in marinara sauce with some cheese on the side. And I'm sitting there going, I think it's worth ruining all your grits and letting them all congeal to have them the next day after I got to eat that. I mean, I thought that was the most brilliant use of grits. And the idea of calling them grit tots was even better.
The craziest one I saw, the chef Edward Lee in Kentucky, lets the pot of grits cool down. And then that skin that forms on the top, he peels that off and bakes it and uses it to dip as a cracker.
All right, we interrupted your journey through grit land.
shrimp and grits from the Lowcountry. Talked about you can do cold grits and put fruit on top of them. You can use your grit leftovers, the little skin on top. You could do, you could stuff grits into tamales. It's mostly just tips and then two recipes.
Okay. Well, you mentioned what Frank does at the Highland Grill in Birmingham. We grow up with something fancy called spoon bread, which is made with grits. And the Poinsett Hotel in Greenville used to be famous for their spoon bread. I don't know that the new version of the Poinsett dining room does that, but that was very famous. The Grand Hotel at Point Clear in Mobile did the same thing. They had spoon bread.
Something I loved about that Highland souffle was it was using these French techniques, but humble Southern ingredients. So that sounds a little bit like the spoon bread, of this yummy baked preparation using the humble grit.
Yeah. I'm sure there's some older Southern cookbooks out from the 40s and 50s that would have a recipe for that.
I love seeing those old recipes for something, and it'll say, cook grits. And that's as far as the recipe will go. Cook grits. And turns out you can actually break that process down even further. There's a huge debate about whether you should be cooking grits with water or another cooking liquid. Some people use chicken stock. Some people use cream. And for many South Carolinians, cream in grits is cheating, that you should be getting that creaminess from the water itself and from the grit itself.
Well, now this is true. And as Greg knows, my wife and I spent many years on Edisto Island, and before that, I was spending it up on the coast near Georgetown. Grits made with the water that you get out of your well in the Lowcountry tastes different and is creamier than the water you get here in Columbia or Greenville or anywhere else.
You go to California and you eat Tartine's Bakery and you wonder why they have this creaminess to their bread that we can't. It has something to do with that water source too and what they're doing there. And it's a lot of the replication of what we do here with the growing, the terroir, as much as the water that we're using to kind of produce it and all.
Well, I know people who do cook their grits with water, but before it comes to the table, they add cream.
Right. Stir in cream after cooking it
cream.
In water. And that does add a creaminess to it. But the actual heat in the water opens up that grit itself and makes it creamy on its own as well.
Traditionally, grits took a while to cook.
You owe it to yourself to get the best stone ground grits you can get your hands on. And then from there, you can stir them on the stove. You also could use an Instant Pot or a crock pot. None other than the director of the Southern Foodways Alliance, John T. Edge, cooks his grits in a crock pot.
Overnight, though.
Overnight.
Yeah.
The one that really cracks me up is Natalie Dupree. She's written a whole cookbook on shrimp and grits. She is a grand dame of Southern cooking. Natalie Dupree cooks all of her grits in the microwave. She uses an anchor hocking type, one of those batter bowls with the handle, puts a little lid on it, stirs them, and she says she sort of forgets about them. She lets them go for an hour. If she remembers, she stops and stirs them. An hour in the microwave. Natalie Dupree.
It is her pet peeve. We've had many discussions on this over the years, and she's still trying to convince me to get my microwave in use with my grits. And she uses my grits all the time. And I knew one of her personal assistants, B said that was the first thing she had to learn how to do with Natalie was to make the microwave grits. And it just seems that oxymoron idea of cooking stone ground grits in that way.
I think it's brilliant. I think Natalie knows that you need to work in a little bit of forgetfulness into a recipe because you'll do something else. You'll look out the window. You'll go talk to a neighbor. You'll talk to your kids. Whatever you're doing, you need to work in a little bit of leeway for yourself. So she just forgets about them. And when she says they're happy to see her when she comes back.
You know, a little bit different, but people in Charleston also, when you talk about how it's cooked is what it's called. We've been referring the whole time to grits, but my mother-in-law and everybody around there would in Charleston use the word hominy, and they mean grits. They do not mean a can of hominy or, you know, a bowl of corn. They still want a bowl of grits, but the word hominy is interchangeable sometimes, and the word polenta sometimes gets interchanged, but not as common as the word hominy.
No, you're right, and then I have heard people say hominy grits.
That's a true Charleston term. I get that all the time. Where are your hominy grits?
And the rest of the country thinks of hominy as what?
I mean, a piece of corn that's been soaked in lye and then wet milled, which is a totally different process. Or, you know, what you get in a grocery store, there's cans of hominy and it's, you know.
It's big hominy.
That yeah, fluffed up.
It's paracartons taken off, use wood ash or lye to get the outside layer removed. But yeah, hominy grits is they still want a bowl of grits. So I've had to kind of learn the terminology and follow people to make sure when they call me and they say, I want hominy grits, I want hominy, sometimes they're all referring to the same product and they just want me to write something different on the bag for them. Well, I think grits are hidden in so much things that people don't realize. We just to throw one out that people have never probably thought of before, the base of one of my favorite snack foods is just that. So when you're eating a Cheeto, that is just grits. That is it starts as raw grits and it's pressed through.
So you're telling me the Cheetos that we got in the bag that get all the orange on us?
That's right.
That's just ground up grits.
It starts the process is just like if I was selling to a high end restaurant, they're getting the same product that a restaurant's getting to make shrimp and grits. That's the base product of it. It's not a fine cornmeal. It's not a flour. It's not a whole corn. They start with grits, and I mean it's something that no one would even know is in there. But that's so for all those kids listeners out there, you can tell your mom and dad you're still getting your grits by eating your Cheetos.
Well, just for the heck of it, I decided to go online and I got this recipe for how to do real Southern grits, how to make true Southern grits. 4 cups of water, 1.5 cup stone ground grits, 2 dried bay leaves. That's
fussing it up a little bit.
Bay is always in there for a lot of people.
Kosher salt, unsalted butter, 2 ounces Parmesan cheese, 1 cup Henry heavy cream. Cooking time, 35 minutes. That's kind of short.
Cooking time is a little short for what they're doing there. But the rest is pretty basic recipe with the 4 cups. A 4-to-1 ratio is pretty common to start. And I always tell people, don't be scared to start with a 4-to-1 ratio. And then from there, if it thickens too much, you can always thin it back out. If it's too thin, it's going to be a long time to thicken it back up.
And we've talked a lot about how purists say cook with water only. And it is true that you only need water to cook with, but it is delicious to stir in cheese at the end. We're not going to argue with stirring in some Parmesan at the end or some cream.
Well, and the other thing you just mentioned is folks who don't get the proportions right and it just...
It's too watery. You know, don't be intimidated, though. Usually it does soak up that water. Grits are not hard. This is ground up corn cooked in water. You can add a little water as you go. you can keep cooking and it'll soak it up. You don't need to be scared of grits.
And the more and more people you see that have done this for a long time, these chefs, these home cooks, there isn't a lot of measuring because they know the pot. They know how much, you know, kind of a drawn line in their head, how high the water should come. And they know how much grits to put in, and they know kind of when to stir before that heat's going to kind of scald it or whatever on the bottom. So it is a muscle memory. It's something that's kind of enjoyable and something that can be enjoyable and not to be a fussy thing. You know, I might one of these days have to join Natalie on her quest here of taking some time to do other things, or this crazy new craze on these Instapots. I mean, that's probably every third call on a recipe question is, how do I do it in an Instapot? You know, that's the new, you know, it's an old steamer and it's an old boiler, double boiler, kind of put in new terms and stuff. And it's interesting that that kind of technology is coming back again.
Need to pause for a moment, let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with Greg Johnsman, a.k.a. Geechee Boy, and C.J. Loetz, the author of an article that appeared in the February-March Garden and Gun about grits. All right, CJ, we asked Greg how he cooked grits. How do you cook grits?
My recipe is simple. I put grits in the pan, rinse them, as Miss Emily on Edisto Island showed me, just rinse off the top part that floats. And then with about a 4-to-1 ratio of water to grits, just simmer them on the stove, stir with a wooden spoon, and then once all of that water has been soaked up, I like to put out different toppings that people can have. So some scallions, maybe a little bit of bacon, some cheese, sort of like a top-your-own grits experience, but with that grit base of just simple grits cooked in water.
We've talked about shrimp and grits, but to me, one of the favorite meals for wintertime, you'd have grits, fried apples or baked apples, but usually fried, and then some good country sausage. And that's still a really, really good winter meal.
Who can argue with that?
I think you bring up a point that no one's helped me figure out. Maybe a listener one day or somebody can help me figure out is why sausage works so much better than bacon and grits. I don't have any, you know, it's not the bacon grease, but when you're doing a dish, anything past just a shrimp and grits, of course, bacon works well there. But if you're doing a dish of just grits, for some reason, for me, sausage works so much better. And I don't know why.
Something about the fat, or what do you think it could be?
I have no idea. I'm not going to argue. I'd probably put both in if you gave me an option.
And we've got some good sources of homemade country sausage here in South Carolina. And of course, you can also add eggs, you know, have eggs with that and, you know, breakfast for supper.
One chef told me that she'll actually poach an egg in her grits. So after the grits are all hot, she'll crack an egg into that well and then let that yolk crack open and pour over the grits. To each his own, right?
Yeah, that sounds pretty good to me. Greg, you are growing not just grits, growing corn. You are really getting into heirloom and heritage vegetables. How many different crops are you dealing with now? And I know most of them are the heritage variety.
They are. And, you know, we started with white and yellow grits and white and yellow cornmeal, and we came from a very large commercial tomato farm that had a lot of other vegetables going on. But currently today, I'd say for the consumers, there's about 17 to about 20 different SKUs, different products. And for chefs, there's a little bit more. And the reason for that is some products like heirloom Bene, it's very difficult for somebody to even need a pound of it, and chefs are buying it by about 12.5 pounds at a time. And we've got heirloom sorghum that they're even popping for dishes and stuff, and a grain sorghum. And there's a lot of people that aren't really looking for that on the retail market as well. So it's a quest to work on these varieties that are missing, but also tie in the southern foodways and the story. And the story is that the people before us, the cultures before us, understood that each variety can help the next. And what I mean is peas, the Sea Island red peas, the rye that we grow creates nitrogen, meaning that a lot of that crop you'll never see on the dinner table. I put it right back in the ground, but it prepares the ground for corn that needs nitrogen, and rice doesn't like that in the ground. So we do this in rotations to help each thing. It helps the environment. It helps, you know, kind of in a biodynamic idea of that farm. So a lot of these varieties are coming out of, we were already growing them, It's simply just trying to be a better steward and use them. I'm working on some apple trees on Edisto Island, and this isn't far from Grits because it started as David Shields, a professor at USC, explained that the early cider vinegar apples were used with corn or rye for crust to make treats. And we found out there was a cider vinegar apple from Edisto. So we're looking to help preserve outside of the grains and the grits to help kind of ensure some of these things are around for people.
Well, you don't think about growing apples on the Sea Island.
When he told me the apple tree is called the Hoover apple from Edisto, I just didn't think it was real. And we did the research and it was. And we've had to do a lot of things to keep the soils in the right, meaning just the water, salt water intrusion doesn't get to it. And we had to think about this, about the grits and all the grains on the coast and all. I mean, we had 70-mile-an-hour winds and 4 years of pretty, you know, 6-8 foot swells of water that really ruined a lot of stuff. So the soil itself has had some problems we've had to look at. But there is something magical. I did not grow up in the low country, but there is something magical about grits. There is something magical about what the soil can do to make these varieties and have these varieties come alive.
All right, CJ, where are you from and how did you get into writing this article?
I grew up in a little town called Eureka, Missouri, and I have family from Florida and North Carolina. I'm the senior editor at Garden and Gun magazine. Garden and Gun is based in Charleston, and we cover the entire South. And I have one of the best jobs out there. As senior editor, I get to find story ideas, talk to readers. I love gardens. I love agriculture and foodways. So I'm constantly researching and trying to find story ideas. And grits just kept coming up. And it turns out so many Garden and Gun readers and chefs and people that we talk to have opinions about grits. So it made sense to talk to at least 50 of them and get their grits advice.
And so you did this story yourself. You didn't assign to somebody else.
I didn't assign. As an editor, I do get the joy of assigning to writers. And then every once in a while, I get to write my own story when it's something that I care about or that I've been gathering ideas for.
So you studied journalism at Missouri's got a great journalism school. Is that where you went to school?
They do have a great journalism school. I went to Indiana University, though, studied journalism. And I had briefly interned at Field & Stream magazine. So I've always had an interest in sporting and the outdoors. And then when I moved to Charleston to work for Garden and Gun, that was in 2013. And since then, I've been finding stories from all over the South.
Okay. All right. Great. And Greg, I was going to ask you, when you were working on your family's tomato farm, how did all of this, where you are now, evolve? Did you go take a course at Clemson, or is this something that you basically have been self-taught?
I don't know if it's self-taught. It's an easy and a hard one to answer. 15, 16 years ago, my father-in-law pulled me aside and said, I'm the youngest. And he said, son, this tomato farm won't be here for the long term for you. He could see the writing on the wall, and not in a bad way, because we're so excited that we can re-embrace and keep the family farm going. But for the listeners to understand, basically, it wasn't labor. It wasn't issues like that. It was that we had a six-week magic growing window, and we saw it closing. We saw that Florida could raise a tomato later in the season. North Carolina could come in earlier. Canada's hothouse production was growing, and we knew Dominican Republic in Mexico was beginning to truck and take over. And he saw this so far early enough, and he encouraged us to look to what we love. My wife knew my childhood. I met a man named Jack Brock, and he took me under his wings, a third generation miller, and he taught me to mill. And my job was not to make moonshine. My job was to run a mill. And I always just looked at it as a hobby and hanging out with a bunch of old friends. And I never thought of anything. And she would go when we were dating to different shows, different agriculture things, and see me help run mills. And know on weekends, I guess people in college when I was at Clemson were going to football games. I was leaving to go to another state to go work at a mill or wherever I could get my hands on old equipment. So the point is she encouraged me with our roadside market to just put one in to show people kind of the art of milling, show them what stone ground. And I remember the two pallets of corn we had, and we were so excited to have our paper bag in our little store to show people. And the scary thing is we were selling vegetables to chefs, but it was scary how fast that – outsold and the time I was putting into milling, meaning when everybody else was sleeping, when the tomato farm was asleep, I was working to try to keep up with orders. And through the years, we've developed techniques because Edisto is the absolute worst place to be a miller. The humidity, the temperatures, everything is working against me. So everything I learned as a kid and putting it together with one of the best markets for getting the product out was the turning point. So it was a progression, and we're a word of mouth mom and pop idea, and that's what I love. Is it's just it grows with somebody has a family get together and they pass on our product, and we love that growth and we love the stories.
What about stories people have told you about grits and what grits meant to them? Growing up, you heard my grit story. I hated it growing up. I love them now. Anything, CJ, when you were researching?
Sure. What springs to mind for me is the chef Scott Peacock, who was well known in Atlanta. And his mentor, his cooking mentor, was Edna Lewis. Edna Lewis was a great matriarch of Southern cooking. She was Virginia raised and then worked in Atlanta and became. She actually worked in South Carolina as well. She worked at Middleton Place and was a chef there. Worked in New York. She became a sort of mentor to Scott Peacock. And she cooked grits on the stove with water, maybe add a little cream at the end. And she always had a pot of grits going. And I think that has been one of the hallmarks of this research about grits, is grits were sort of always there. No matter where you grew up in the South, you always had somebody in your family who just had a pot of grits going that you could add to. If they cooled off a little bit, maybe you used the leftovers as grit cakes, or maybe you kept a pot going and you topped them with a little bit of butter or cheese. So I think just that they're sort of like bread in the South, you know, grits are just there and present. And I like that idea of mentorship and teaching this simple, humble Southern recipe, this lauded, beloved chef Edna Lewis teaching her friend Scott Peacock how to make them and passing that down through the generations.
All right. Any stories, Greg, that you would like to share?
I've got too many stories, Walter. That's the problem. It's a daily occurrence. I think probably the best story to share is I was in the middle of running my first mill in our market. Took me a couple years to restore, and it was a transition from really running the tomato farm and just worrying about milling. And I had a near and dear friend come in. My wife and me were behind on a large order for a well-known restaurant, and I was trying to get it done and fighting a couple problems and getting it all done. And he looked at me and he said, are you giving thanks, and are you thinking about all the people this reaches? And I was like, no, sir, I'm just trying to get this order done. I've got to get it out. He said, you're missing the point. I've run a business too long to tell you that you have such a thing of power that you're missing. If you can pray over these and you can think about these people, the impact in which you have, and that's reshaped our business. We do constantly think about every dinner party, every opportunity of friends getting together, every opportunity for somebody to break bread. And in that thought, we get to be a part of it. And it gives us a pleasure of why we're doing this. And we're doing a slower process on purpose. There's ways of milling faster, but there's a reason why I do it. It's not gluttony for punishment. It's the idea of it creates a better product. And if I can get a better product and give it to people that are going to enjoy, then it has been worth it. And I try to remember everybody that works with us why we're doing it. So it's that partnership.
All right. Well, before we sign off, we need to remind our listeners that there is a Grits Festival in South Carolina.
World Grits Festival.
In St. George. It's every April. And some statistic I read is that Dorchester County consumes more grits per person than any place else in the world.
The local Piggly Wiggly found that out. So to honor that, the festival has the Rolling in the Grits competition, where you try to adhere as many grits to your body as possible.
Now, that doesn't exactly excite me.
And also, don't we have a state amendment in the books that it's our official food or something?
That's probably true, Greg. We have so many official state things. It runs to about 4 pages now. But if we don't, we probably should. That's better than some of the things we've got.
And grits show up culturally many places. My Cousin Vinny has an entire grit scene in that movie. Grits have made their way into an Outkast song. They've made their way into music and television. So they're a part of our pop culture. And there's the famous Kiss My Grits. They're part of the lexicon of our country now.
Well, but see, most people don't remember Flo at Mel's Diner. Which is where
that's Kiss My Grits.
Yes, that's Kiss My Grits. That's where.
I'm not saying that to you. Don't worry.
No. No, that was her not so nice way of saying bless your heart. It was just telling you off. Kiss My Grits. Okay. All right. CJ and Greg, Alfred's given me the wind up sign. Any last words for our listeners? And CJ, I'll let you go first.
Well, thank you to everyone who read the Garden and Gun February March Ultimate Guide to Grits. And don't be intimidated by grits. Get some stone ground grits and some water and get in the kitchen and just try to make some grits.
Greg?
For all the listeners, I think for me it's just an opportunity to look at what the state has created. But more importantly, if a family's sitting on a beautiful varietal, please have it checked. Please have it looked at. Cox Prolific came in just a year or two ago, a very prominent variety of corn that was found in the upstate, and it's making its way back to the dinner plate, and it's very exciting to hear these stories.
All right. Well, Greg Johnsman and CJ Lotz, thanks so much for being with us today on The Journey.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal. I know that I did. Talking with Greg Johnsman about growing heritage varieties of corn to produce grits in a form that folks in 17th century South Carolina would have known, and C.J. Lotz and the many recipes and stories that she gathered from chefs around the country, not just from around the South. A lot of it all boils down to grits and a signature dish, shrimp and grits, can be traced right back here to South Carolina. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. The producer and engineer is Alfred Turner. Production of this program is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.